From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made just over 10 years ago when a tech company was facing a big problem. One of their most significant clients was going to fire them. And the company is called Blue Wolf. It's a software consulting firm. They couldn't find a specific programming skill that their client needed, and the company had a bunch of well-educated engineers, but nothing could please this client. This is the story told by Blue Wolf CEO Eric Berridge in a TED Talk that has picked up more than 1 million views. Berridge says the Blue Wolf team went to the bar and was, you know, doing what they do. They share their story with the bartender, this one named Jeff. After listening and commiserating for a while, Jeff had an idea. "Send me in there," he said. "Let me talk to those guys. Let me talk to your client." And of course, at first, everyone laughed. "Send the bartender." Well, the next morning, the software team was thinking about it. Jeff was a philosophy dropout from Penn. He didn't know technology, but he understood how to listen, how to approach disagreements and problems, how to think more deeply. And so, why not? They sent Jeff in to talk to the client. And it worked. Jeff helped the client see what the company could do. He helped Blue Wolf see what the client valued. And it was a new way of looking at a problem. That client became one of the company's best references, and today the company has more than quintupled in size. But most of Blue Wolf's new hires are not engineers or tech students. They hire artists, writers, musicians. Their chief technology officer was an English major and a bike messenger in Manhattan, by the way. This is a company that very much believes that the arts and humanities are vital in the STEM world. Berridge says that the national obsession with STEM is a colossal mistake. He's not saying STEM is bad. He's saying we overemphasize it to our own detriment. He's coming to Rochester next week to help lead an event at the MCC Institute for the Humanities. The event called Why STEM Needs the Arts and Humanities, Education and Industry in the 21st Century. But first, he's on the line with us, our guest for the hour on Connections. Eric, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
And also with us here in studio, Michael Jacobs is the Dean of Humanities and Social Sciences and Director for the Institute for the Humanities at MCC. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Amanda Roth is an Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Women's and Gender Studies at SUNY Geneseo. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
The event, 1 week from tonight, Wednesday, May 1st, and that's happening from 6 to 8:30. And the Brighton campus with MCC, pretty simple, right? People can attend free. What do people need to know, Michael?
Absolutely. Attendance is free. We ask that you register in advance. We have plenty of seating left, though it's filling up quickly.
Eric is going to be there. And I got to say, Eric, this story is so good that the first time I watched it, I was like, come on. Like, really? Like, the bartender. But, you know, I mean, I understand why it's gone viral, because this is the story that helps demonstrate all of this talk about whether arts and the humanities can really play with STEM. And the answer is it can. But why don't you tell me a little bit more about some of the background there? Because, you know, that story is such a good one. Tell me a little bit about Jeff and why it worked out.
Sure, absolutely. And I think you hit a lot of it really well in your introduction. And the story is absolutely factual. We're still living it to this day in our business. A little update, we were actually purchased by IBM just about 3 years ago. So now Blue Wolf is an IBM company, and we're helping IBM at a global scale to also realize this dream of just bringing diverse groups of people in front of clients to achieve results and outcomes. I think the biggest change we've seen in the last 15 years in the technology space, which is where I've spent my entire career, specifically in the software space, is that a lot of these technologies are becoming easier to use. And things like cloud computing have given us the ability to use mobile devices in a way that we've never been able to before. And they come with them a very configurable way of doing things, so that someone who's well-educated, someone that can communicate, someone that can quickly pick up on things, can get fluent on these technologies in a short period of time, which sometimes puts us in a position where we don't necessarily need a degree in computer science or a degree in engineering. Like I also say in the TED Talk, yes, you know, the next bridge we all drive across or the next elevator we all jump in, we want to make sure there's an engineer behind that. But a lot of the technologies today that are out there can be adapted to by people from all walks of life. And that's really what's exciting about our business today.
So there's one section of the talk, and I was kind of talking to our guests in studio about this, and we're going to get their thoughts on this too. There's one section of your talk that I thought was really important, because as compelling as the story is, Eric, What I want to make sure I understand is, can you really give this advice to students, to parents who are thinking about their kids and futures, ROI on education? I ask that because, look, if you're the guy whose TED Talk went viral because you did something differently, that's cool. But is this an industry-wide trend to value the humanities? You do point to, I think, Facebook, Google, Apple, and something like two-thirds of their hiring isn't these technical degrees. Why don't you tell me a little bit more about that, because help us see that this isn't just a really cool one-company, one-off outlier story.
Yeah, well, I'll start by saying I am the parent of teenagers. I have a junior in college right now. I have a rising freshman in college and a sophomore in high school. So, you know, it's risky territory because you don't want to give parents or children bad advice, period. And I think we definitely live in an era where all the successes today seem to be driven by technology. These tech companies represent 8 of the 10 largest valued companies in the world when you look at Apple, Google, Facebook, LinkedIn, et cetera, Microsoft. But if you look under the covers and look at who they're actually hiring, and this is publicly available information that sits on LinkedIn, almost 70% of their open jobs are for non-technical roles. And they're hiring marketers, sellers, HR specialists, designers, creative people, because these enterprises are being built by individuals that not only can build amazing technical products, but they understand why to build them, and they understand what end users ultimately need to make life a better pursuit. So, you know, I think going down the STEM path just because it seems like the right thing to do and forcing people down that path because we think that's where all the jobs will be is a mistake. I think you need to let students open their eyes to a myriad of subjects and tack towards what really drives their passions. And it's always been that way. All I'm trying to say is that's not changing.
Okay. And I also want to ask you then, before I get our guests in studio, to kind of weigh in on that, because that's a great jumping off point. There's a lot of people listening who are thinking about their high school age kids or people thinking about their own work or their own educational career, or their own future job opportunities. But you have observed not just your industry, Eric, but also presidential administrations and the federal government and this push towards STEM. And you were pretty critical of that in your TED Talk. What would you have said to President Obama? What would you say now to President Trump when it comes to a lot of this focus on STEM?
Well, I think we have to value all these subjects equally. And, you know, I'm not the only one saying this out in the marketplace. I think, you know, Obama diverted a ton of funds towards STEM. President Trump has done the same thing, and in his defense, he's actually done less of it than Obama did. But, you know, the questions we're not asking is, what do you get out of the humanities? Why is it important to be able to read and write and collaborate and think critically? Why will communication be the number one skill set that we will need in this workforce over the next 50 years? And that's something that Warren Buffett's talking about today. You know, he was asked last week, what's the number one skill you would recommend in business to a rising college student? And he emphatically said, the ability to communicate, the ability to read and write. And these are things that the humanities just devours. It's, you know, I was an English major, and I spent my time as an undergrad at UC Berkeley reading and writing and thinking critically and getting beaten up by my professors because they didn't agree with my view and I'd have to defend it. Those skill sets are critical in today's technical workforce.
Let me ask our guests in studio to weigh in. And I'm going to start with Amanda Roth here because I joked with her before the hour began that as a professor of philosophy, you know, I have talked to students who say, I would love to study philosophy. And then where do I work? The philosophy factory? You know, that's the old sort of saw here. Mm-hmm. But what's the real practical pitch that you give them to say, look, think about it more broadly than that?
Yeah, sure. So I'm definitely familiar with that joke, having, you know, undergraduate degrees in philosophy and women's and gender studies. But I was actually just yesterday at an accepted students event talking to students and parents. And indeed, this question, what are you going to do with that, was the question for both women's and gender studies and philosophy. And I think, you know, one thing to say, you know, up front is there's not going to be one path. There's no philosophy factory. You're not going to find job ads that, for the most part, that are going to specifically say, I want someone with this major. So if you're looking for something where there's a direct path, there's this major, 50-year career set out ahead of you. You're not going to get that from philosophy or most, you know, humanities subjects. But I actually think, you know, are you going to get that from STEM subjects either? So is there a sort of mistake in thinking that somehow having the technical expertise is going to set you on a path that I know exactly where I'm going for my career path? So some of the work that's being done on this issue, some of the data out there, you know, points out, I've got one stat here, the U.S. Department of Labor predicts 65% of children in school today will work in jobs that haven't yet been created. So that sort of speaks to the... How can it be that technical expertise in terms of the technical knowledge we have now, right, what we're using now, how can that be the path to a career that's going to last 40 or 50 years? So sort of starting with that, I would then want to point to, not just for philosophy, but for humanities generally, I would want to sort of emphasize the sense of critical thinking, imaginative skills, and especially dealing with values. So maybe I'll talk about values a bit just because I'm a moral philosopher, a little biased in favor of values. But, you know, I've got, you know, data on you know, workforces, hiring agencies, et cetera. I'm talking about, you know, the ability to think ethically, as Eric put it, you know, the ability to think about the why and the what. You know, we have technical expertise, but what should we use it for? And that's really to think about what is it to be a human being? How should we live together? What do we care about and why do we care about those things? And that's the bread and the butter of the humanities.
Do you watch The Good Place?
Yes. I'm not caught up on the last season. But.
See, I mean, a philosophy major could go write for a major national show. There's all... but honestly, I really appreciate the focus on ethics and values.
Yeah.
And I think there's broad application across the tech world and everywhere on that. Michael, how do you view this question on sort of fitting these things together that sometimes seem disparate?
Yeah, so it's a pretty complex question, right? And, you know, I'll go out there and say that if you want to be an engineer, you probably shouldn't major in lit with a concentration in, you know, literary modernism, right? I don't want my engineers to be without that engineering background. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't provide the opportunity and the encouragement for those subjects to be studied in school. And what's happened in higher education as I think a reflection of kind of a shift in our culture is that we've become hyper-focused in the realm of STEM education. And so if you look at a lot of STEM programs, there's very little room for the exploration of the quote-unquote liberal arts, the arts, humanities, and social sciences. And that's much to the detriment of the student, right? Because we know that these are subjects and areas of study that help with adaptability. You know, a lot of the technology that students are learning on in these STEM disciplines will be obsolete in 10 years, right? As will a lot of the, you know, social structures or organizational structures. And so a firm grounding in the humanities, the arts, humanities, social sciences, provides that capacity for adaptability. It also provides the capacity for an individual to develop as a manager if he or she wishes to do so, for an individual to understand cultural trends and therefore market trends, an individual to understand organizational culture and competition. So, you know, we need to, if I'm doing my job, right, as an academic administrator, I'm working with my fellow deans and other administrators and faculty to create cross-disciplinary collaboration so that some of the STEM courses are contextualized in a humanities sense, but also so that our programs aren't so dense with program-specific courses that students don't have the opportunity for that exploration.
Yeah, our guests and Eric Berridge in particular, they're not saying that these companies, Blue Wolf or any company that's what you would put in the broad umbrella of a tech company, they're not saying that the engineering jobs are not being done by engineers. They're saying that if you look at a company with 1,000 jobs and you assume it's all tech jobs, it's much more diverse and interesting than that. And a lot of these companies are seeing the value in bringing people in. But Eric, let me ask you about that directly. If you really are hiring musicians and writers and artists, how do you get them to know that they ought to be applying with you anyway? How are you kind of finding this field of talent?
Well, a lot of that is just using modern social media recruiting tools. A lot of it's employee referrals. A lot of it's just telling our story. You know, we happen to be in a market where our core business is actually supporting the Salesforce product, for those of you that are familiar with it. They do a great job of promoting the fact that they can welcome folks from all walks of life and teach them their platform very easily and very quickly through a lot of online learning and through a lot of shared collaborative use cases. So it's a multi-prong approach, and I think building diverse teams of folks with engineers, with philosophers, with folks from all walks of life also just creates an incredibly creative environment where you end up building the right things. And that's fun, and that's the power of it that organizations experience.
Well, Eric, you mentioned in your TED Talk that Jeff the bartender story has sort of been repeated. So can you point to another example where someone without necessarily a STEM degree works for you and has either solved a problem or helped kind of spur a success?
Yeah, I mean, we have hundreds of them. there's so many examples out there. You know, one example I love to talk about, it's not our company, but it's a company we're all familiar with. It is about to go public here, Uber. If you look at Uber's story, a couple of their founders were computer science majors. One of them was a college dropout. But they tell the story about building Uber not in the way of, you know, hey, we wanted to build this cool application. They were just trying to get a ride. They were sitting in their apartment on Russian Hill in San Francisco, and they couldn't get a cab. And so they looked at the problem not from a technologist perspective, but from just an everyday walk of life perspective. Like, what are we missing? And then how can we use technology to fill that gap? And what we're constantly trying to do is find people that can ask those challenging questions and come up with solutions that will fill those gaps. Finding the people then that can write code or configure a complex application then becomes, you know, the secondary need. But the primary need in any business situation or in any social situation is to define the context around you. And I'm a firm believer that we learn those things through history. We learn those things through literature. We learn those things through our human experience. And if we undervalue that, and if we overvalue actually what we're building, I think we're going to build the wrong thing.
All right, we're talking to Eric Barrage, the CEO of Blue Wolf. Michael Jacobs is here with us in studio, the Dean of Humanities and Social Sciences and the Director of the Institute for the Humanities at Monroe Community College. Amanda Roth, a Professor of Philosophy and Women's and Gender Studies at SUNY Geneseo. They're here because 1 week from tonight, the MCC Institute for the Humanities is bringing in Eric Barrage, for example, is one of the people helping lead this event on why STEM needs the arts and humanities, education and industry in the 21st century. Eric is really one of the in-demand speakers because his TED Talk went super nuclear viral. People love the story, and it is fleshing out in practical ways this idea that we've heard a lot about in recent years, but maybe we haven't always been able to visualize, which is how STEM and the arts and the humanities can work together. So that event, starting at 6 p.m. next Wednesday night, is on the Brighton campus of MCC, and it's free. They just want you to register in advance, and we'll put a link on our sites to that if you want to attend. It's sites.monroecc.edu/humanities. Easy to find, but we'll also put it up on our platforms if you want. And listeners, I'm going to start taking some of your feedback here because I want to hear from you on this. How do you feel about the dovetailing of STEM with arts and the humanities? Would you consider it for your own kids? Would you be comfortable with them if they, oh my gosh, got a philosophy degree? And maybe in your own experiences. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Paul in Irondequoit first on the phone. Go ahead, Paul.
Hello, and I just wanted to mention a few things. I love this discussion, and I am a arts major, and I graduated right down the road from where Eric went to school. I went to California College of Arts and Crafts, and I graduated with a degree in drawing, of all things. And I further, just a couple of years ago, I got another degree in multidisciplinary studies at Rochester Institute of Technology. And I've always been successful. And the one thing, I have two 18-year-old boys, they're twins, and both of them were interested in music and theater, and the one loves to write. And I say go for it, because that's what feeds you. And I hear all this talk, whatever the storyline, like college is a waste of money and there's no return on investment. And I disagree with that totally. I think, yeah. And there's one other thing that I wanted to say.
Sure.
As far as philosophy is going, there was a writer at UC Berkeley, and Eric probably knows who this is. His name was T.S. Kuhn's. And he wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolution. And it's the best book I ever read in my life. And it basically discusses exactly this, is that you have a world or whatever that it's not a relay race where you hand a baton to somebody. What happens is the world changes, and it's totally different. And our kids are growing up in a world that is not the same world that we grew up in.
Yeah.
That's all I got
to
say.
Paul, thank you for that. Good luck to your twins. And as a twin myself, I'm sorry for that. But, you know, sounds like you've done a great job. And, you know, what Paul is saying there, not only sharing his own story, but he's saying, I'm telling my kids, go for it. Do what you want. That is, I don't remember Eric Berridge's exact words in his TED Talk, but that's close to your admonition at the end of it, Eric, which is absolutely do, you know, follow, you know, your dreams and sort of your skills and wherever it takes. Don't force yourself into STEM if that's not a natural fit for you. But Eric, for every time we talk about this, I get email from some parents who say, baloney, we have to consider ROI. Higher education is very expensive, and I better know average starting salary, who's hiring, and I just can't get there mentally, parents are telling me sort of privately. So sell them on the ROI that you see that Paul is talking about for his kids, Eric.
Absolutely. And look, let's remind ourselves that ROI is the two parts of that equation. And I'm not saying that education isn't overpriced. I think it's crazily overpriced. And I think the fact that this country has $1.5 trillion worth of student debt is a travesty, and it's something we have to deal with. And that's a big part of the ROI equation. But when you look at the jobs that are out there, and I think we've already discussed this a little bit, we have no idea in the next 10 to 20 years which jobs are going to be available. You know, Deloitte says that over half the jobs that exist today are going to go away, but they're not saying that our employment won't double. So part of it is just being prepared to be a professional individual. Part of it is building out your own networks of friends and colleagues that are going into the workforce. Making the assumption that if you learn a technical skill, you will automatically be employable, I think is a false one, because this technology is changing very quickly. And I also think, you know, there was a point in time where if you wanted to program a computer, you literally needed 10 years of solid skills. You needed an undergraduate degree in computer science. You probably needed a graduate degree in computer science. And in today's day and age, with these newer technologies and newer technologies, newer programming languages, you can pick this stuff up pretty quickly. So if you want to study philosophy, not to go into the philosophy factory because we know that doesn't exist, but you can also take classes that are STEM-based classes at your university. You can take them in high school. My son is taking a computer science class today. I don't envision that he will become a computer engineer, but he's getting exposed to it as well, so that downstream, if that's something he wants to pursue, he still can. And I think that's the biggest change that we've seen. And I think the jobs are going to be out there. Our economy will continue to grow over time. The jobs will change. The workplace is changing dramatically today. But we just can't predict exactly what skills we're going to need 5 to 10 years from now.
And before I turn to Amanda and Michael in studio to kind of pick up that thread on their thoughts on this, one more point on the question of what jobs may be threatened. I think there is an assumption that a lot of people make, and I've probably done it myself, when I think about the future of automation and what technology has made easier, we often think about fast food jobs. We think about some manufacturing jobs. And this is what the Andrew Yangs of the world are pushing us to think more about, should think about the fact that what seems complex now, whether it's that 10 years of work to get kind of computer programmable, which now is much more condensed and simpler, or radiologists, there's so much work that is more automatable, or, well, whatever that word would be, that I'm wondering, Eric, if we need to keep in mind that just going into STEM doesn't insulate you from automation, and that becoming a good thinker and problem solver will be just as important in the future in a sort of a changing economy. How do you feel about that?
I agree with that 100%. I think you need to be able to do that with technical acumen. Like, we can't ignore technology.
Sure.
We use technology today to solve so many things in our lives. But I think the point you're making is, you know, a lot of these technical jobs are going to be automated as well. You know, computers will program themselves. They already are programming themselves. I think that if you are performing a task inside of a business or inside of society, you can bet that it can be automated. However, if you're coming up with a solution, if you're creating a new way of doing things, if you are the disruptor, you'll never be automated. And I think those are the types of people that we're trying to put into the workforce over the course of the next couple of decades.
Well, I'm looking at a book that's now, I think, more than a decade old, A More Beautiful Question, The Power of Inquiry to Spark Breakthrough Ideas, that, you know, Michael, I'm thinking about one of the reasons that the author wrote that book was a frustration that with all of this information at our hands, we're not always all that good at asking the right questions, which maybe was what the bartender at Blue Wolf needed to do, or maybe what arts and humanities majors can bring to STEM fields, asking the right questions, communicating in more effective ways. Do you see that sometimes with students? You say, wow, you know, you're really well trained in one particular subject, but broadening your thinking and applying that, you know, if you can't do that, where do we go with this? Do you see that?
Absolutely. I mean, I saw it for the entirety of my teaching career. You know, I moved into administration a few years ago, but I'll be returning to the classroom in the fall just to get my bearings again. But, you know, something that I was talking to David Munson, the president of RIT, not too long ago, and he said something really profound. He said, you know, and this is an engineer, right? And he was the dean of engineering at the University of Michigan. So he's an engineer's engineer, right? A guy firmly grounded in STEM. But he said that for many of our problems, we've already come up with a scientific solution, and he used climate change as an example. We know what the scientific solution to that is. But how do we solve the problem of implementation?
What right? a great point, because climate change is largely solvable with things we already have, if we choose to.
Yeah, but it's implementation. How do we implement that change? And that requires people with creative and critical habits of mind. It requires people who understand other people. And I want to go back to one of your questions earlier, because you were asking for examples of individuals at Blue Wolf who have the same kind of background or story
sure.
that Eric does. And there's a great book by Scott Hartley called The Fuzzy and the Techie. And you can imagine, right, what he's talking about there, really this confluence of the arts and humanities on one hand and the tech world on the other. And he points to a really famous example, which is a scientist by the name of Melissa Sefkin, who works for Nissan, and she is the principal scientist in their autonomous vehicle division. She's an anthropologist. She's not an engineer, right? Because when you are thinking about the intersections, when you're thinking about programming a vehicle to do what a person does, you want people who understand the fundamentals of human behavior. So that's a reason why a lot of these self-driving companies, self-driving divisions at these car companies hire philosophers and ethicists, because they're the ones who you want informing that programming going on.
Yeah, Professor Joel Helfrich, who helped organize this event next week, sent me that note before the program. Look at who Nissan selected to lead its autonomous car division, an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. You know, so it kind of goes against what you might assume at times. How do you see this? Do you see students sometimes struggling to kind of to bridge and make more practical what they've learned?
Well, I wanted to sort of jump on to yeah. the idea of reframing problems and thinking about how the humanities can kind of help us do that. So I want to actually give a quote from another book on this topic called Sense Making. It's a quote from Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's an astrophysicist. And he says, in science, when human behavior enters the equation, things go nonlinear. That's why physics is easy and sociology is hard. And I kind of love this on multiple levels. One, sort of, you know, complicating the I think, stereotype that STEM is rigorous and difficult, and the humanities and social sciences, it's all opinion-based and, you know, emotion. And I think that's important. But also, I think it really gets at something that, right, you know, as we're talking about, you know, technical expertise is one thing. We need it. It's so important. But yet, right, like in the climate change example, you know, we have it, but it's not all we need. So that it's really the sort of the dealing with the human, or, you know, having that great technical idea is – how are you going to sell it to people, right? What you have to understand human beings and understand how we live together, what we want, our values, in order to kind of put those two things together to sort of be successful. I also wonder if I could just have a tiny pushback against the sort of thinking in terms of ROI. Not that we shouldn't be thinking about, you know, the horrendous cost of higher education, the student loan crisis. These are such important things. But at the same time, I wonder if there's a little room to sort of think, right, if we think about education as directly mapping onto a career path, right, are we sort of narrowing things too much? So I sometimes have students who, right, they already know what the career path is that they want, and they say, what major should I take up in order to get that career path? And I sometimes ask them, you know, can you step back for a moment and can you think, what if you could have that career path with, you know, 20 different majors? What do you actually want to know? What are you passionate about, right? What are you going to be successful thinking about? And maybe we can think about your career path and what you want to know and how you can become a thinker at the same time, rather than thinking college is merely a means or education is a mere means to a career path.
Yeah, this concept, it's interesting how much this concept travels. It is a surprising number of the best athletes in various sports in the world who were multi-sport athletes growing up. And yet a lot of parents these days think, and I've been there, you know, thinking about what sport will my son like? It's like you've got to choose one, and then you've just got to go like hell at that all year round and to the exclusion of all others if you want to be good, if you want to be competitive. And then it turns out it's actually pretty good to do a lot of different things. And some of the best athletes in the world are multi-sport athletes or are really good at different disciplines. So that concept, it's just interesting how often it travels, and yet how often we're pushing kids and pushing students in one very narrow direction. Let me read a little bit of feedback from listeners, and then we'll take some phone calls, because we could probably do this all day, it turns out. Andy writes to us to say, in my experience, employers are looking for life skills, such as how to communicate, how to lead, job-specific tasks are easily taught. I started in archaeology, I worked in food service, now in optics. My experience makes me a better employee. That's from Andy, and that's exactly what some of our guests have been talking about. Here is Noah says, what about visual arts and creativity and its importance in the business world? I think that is greatly underappreciated. And Laura wrote to us to say, haven't there been news accounts lately of art history courses being integrated into med school curriculum, as it has been seen that the essential skills of empathy that are supported by exposure to the humanities are enhanced by this area of study? Of course, we need our medical professionals to be expertly prepared in the technical sense, but we also need them to be able to relate to their patients as human beings, not only diseases. The humanities supports this. That's from Laura, and she sends some supporting documents, which I trust you as a field producer, Laura, on the money. Absolutely. So let's do this. Let's get our only break of the hour, and let's come back to some of your phone calls, because our listeners have a lot to share of their own thoughts and experiences as we talk about why STEM needs the arts and humanities, education and industry in the 21st century. That is the theme for an event next Wednesday night, May 1st, at the MCC Institute for the Humanities. It's on the Brighton campus of MCC. Easy to find on monroecc.edu if you want to register in advance, or we'll put it on our various platforms. The Dean of Humanities and Director of the Institute is Michael Jacobs. He's here. Amanda Roth is a Professor of Philosophy and Women's and Gender Studies at SUNY Geneseo. She's here. And on the line with us is CEO Eric Berridge of Blue Wolf, whose TED Talk has gone super nuclear viral, the story of why this works. So let's get that break and come back to your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we sit down with Monroe County District Attorney Sandra Dorley. She's running for re-election. Earlier this month, we sat down with a challenger in that race. Thursday, we sit down with the district attorney to discuss her record and her vision. In our second hour, we get ready for the launch of Avengers Endgame, the politics of Thanos, and everything that our panel is excited about. Join the conversation Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get to your phone calls. John in Irondequoit, next on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Yes. Hi, Evan. How you doing?
Very good.
Long-time listener, first-time caller. I love the show.
Well, thanks for calling. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was listening, and I definitely have to agree. We definitely need more arts and humanities in education and in connection with STEM and all the other things. It really helps round out a person's ability to problem solve and use critical thinking skills, which seem to be so lacking in the generations coming up these days, from my experience with a lot of them anyways. I was kind of thinking along those lines. One of the things that I've noticed with the children at a very young age, you know, we're talking even preschool or kindergarten, first grade, second grade, there are a lot of programs and books and things that teach children how to develop emotionally and understand their feelings and you know, relate to each other on that level. But it would be great if they had a little more on the lines of problem-solving skills and technical-type things, like, you know, stories and children's books about people solving problems in the technical world and not just emotional problems or feelings. You know, because when I was a kid, I used to love taking things apart and seeing how they worked, and very curious as to, you know, how things, you know, building everything from building blocks and playing in the sandbox and that kind of thing really helped build my critical thinking and problem-solving skills, which helped me immensely later in life. And it seems a lot of the teenagers I run into coming out of high school and moving into career positions and jobs, they just are lacking so terribly in how to use a screwdriver or how to figure out how something fits together. You know, I was just curious if your guests had a take on that, and they believe that's important as well.
All right, John. Well, thank you for that. And, you know, I'm going to pick up on Eric Berridge's thread from earlier with the story of Uber. The story of Uber is people who saw a problem and said, we've got to figure out a way to solve it and make it practical. John, you and I happen to agree that children's books needs an overhaul in this country. I'm not a big fan. And, look at the opportunity. Let's have lunch, John, you and I. We're going to quit our jobs and write children's books and make a mint. You know, I joke, but honestly, I think there may be something to that. And I think there's something to this idea that kids are not really being taught problem-solving skills as much. And then by the time you get to high school, things flip and it's all like all STEM, or at least there's a really strong emphasis on STEM that continues right into higher education. So I'm going to kick this first to Eric Berridge, who in his TED Talk, Eric, you said, our workforce needs specialized skill, but that skill requires a far less rigorous and formalized education than it did in the past. Can you explain more of what you mean there and maybe respond to some of what you heard from John?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that, as I said, a lot of these technologies are moving so quickly, but they're getting easier to use. And our methods of learning have changed so dramatically that it's not textbook learning any longer. So to dive in and pick up a skill very quickly is something that students can do. And they can do it at the high school level. They can do it at the secondary level. They can do it at the graduate level. They can do it in a work environment. So developing skills at a specialized level, I think, is a different thing than it was in the past. I think the examples around just being able to pick things up and put them together and think in a functional way at the same time that you can think in a non-structured way is really where the magic happens for people. And some of it is just having the ability to create the art of the possible in your head, knowing that, yes, we've actually solved climate change, but now how do you get society to get behind that? That's a complex problem that requires a full mind of thinking. So I agree with that 100%. The other thing that I think is really important that we touched upon earlier that I want to make sure doesn't get lost is this whole notion around values. Because if you look at the conversation that is happening today, particularly around these big internet platforms, it's all around values. And these companies are being misguided. And they're becoming dangerous in some respects. So having people in those organizations that can have a value-based conversation and can create value-based cultures is going to be very important to how these platforms survive and thrive in the future. And we all use them today, so we want them to.
Hmm. You want to add to that, Amanda?
Great. I'm thinking about values. One of the things I wanted to sort of get out there is I think this goes beyond just the STEM humanities conversation, but that a sort of general point about, you know, how we come at issues of value in our society is that, I find a lot of students, and I think, you know, adults as well, tend to sort of just think that, well, you can't reason about values. You can't engage in critical thinking about values. They're just kind of like opinions. You know, yours is no better than mine. There's nothing really to say. And I think that's one of the things that humanities education can really do for us and needs to do for us in our society is make room that no, we can have reasoned discussions. We need to do that, right? And we need this sort of guidance, you know, within STEM, within tech, but I would say, you know, in our society more generally as well.
Okay, Michael?
If I can look at it from an even broader perspective, the thing that we, I think, lose sight of in these conversations, particularly in an educational context, is that technology is really there to serve us, right? Human beings. We develop it for our own benefit, so much so that the history of human development is very much linked to the history of our scientific and technological development. And, you know, throughout our history, we have shaped and reshaped what it means to be human. So STEM education industry in this particular paradigm needs people who understand the human condition, not simply to problem solve in a general sense, but to function for the good of humanity. And I firmly believe, and maybe I'm biased because all of my academic background is in the arts and humanities, but that understanding is best provided within that kind of arts and humanities education.
Okay. Well, how about a little dissent? Here's Robert in Fairport, okay, who's going to push back a little. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, I think that STEM is a really hard sell for most kids because when you think about subjects like math and science, they're not the first thing that kids kind of want to undertake. And I think that the message that's being conveyed is a message that people want to hear, but it may not be at least the message that your guest is transmitting here is the message that parents may want to hear, but maybe it's not the message they should be getting. If you look at some graduates from recent programs, and this is according to David K. Johnston, a number of engineering grads between 2016 and 2017, according to a recent tweet of his, is down 7.3%. I can tell you from having a child that is in a master's level program in technology that if you look at the students in that program, they're overwhelmingly Asian and foreign. Not many American kids are taking some of these, are pursuing some of these technical degrees in some of the STEM fields, and we need more of them. We don't need less of them.
Okay, Robert, thank you. Go ahead, Eric Berridge.
Well, I definitely think we need more of them. I think we need more graduates, period. I just don't believe that we should overemphasize and create this perception that there is a dearth of technology talent in the marketplace. I think we need to value these subjects on equal footing. And that's really what I try to get at in my talk. Look, I work for a tech company. I've built my whole career around technology. I fully understand the need and the power of complex computing and engineering. But I get nervous when I see parents and when I see business leaders start to make these great claims that it's the only path in the future, because I think that's a dangerous path to go down. I think there's another educational model that we need to look at as well, because I think, you know, we can look at a six-year education starting as a freshman in high school and actually build incredible technical talent in this country without having to go down the expensive four-year undergraduate path and graduate path after that. So that's another thing to think about.
Okay. Michael, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I should, but in terms of the arts and humanities majors and trends in the last 15, 20 years, I would kill for a 7% decline because it is dropped exponentially in the last, I would say, 2 to 3 decades or so.
Okay, and you know, Eric, we're in the town of Kodak here, and this is a company in this town that once employed more than 65,000 people, that obviously pioneered photography, film, and also happens to have the guy who invented the digital camera working for them, which, you know, he's such a good and nice guy, and I don't want to speak too much about that because he has even cautioned me. He thinks the story is more complex than just Kodak invented the digital camera and then sat on it and didn't do anything with it. But it you can't deny the fact that Kodak fell apart because other people started doing things in this digital imagery realm that they just weren't ready to do and weren't doing. And now they employ a couple thousand and they're sort of a nothing in this town. I don't know how familiar you are with their story, Eric, but do you see that as sort of a cautionary tale here in this field?
I think it's one of the best stories out there. And with all due respect to an amazing American iconic company that we all grew up with, you know, what happened there was they didn't actually understand their reason for being. And, you know, if you had told a Kodak shareholder 35, 40 years ago that the number of pictures that we took as a society was going to increase by a millionfold or whatever that number is, and we're all going to get off of this broadcast sometime today and take another 50 pictures ourselves and post them online and do whatever we do. If you had told a shareholder of Kodak that, they would have backed up the truck. Kodak thought that they were a camera company and a film company. They were a memory company. I went down to the photo mat to get my film developed, not because I was intrigued with the technical process as to how that happened. I wanted to see my pictures. And you know, there's a story to be told that if when companies know what they actually provide the consumer from an emotional perspective, they get ahead of the technology and they continue to provide those things at a more convenient pace. And I think that's the trap of engineering, is if you engineer for engineering's sake, you actually miss out on your reason for being.
Hmm. Powerful stuff. Let me grab a couple more phone calls. Karen and Henrietta. Go ahead, Karen.
Yes, hi. This is just an absolutely amazing, fantastic talk, and it's so massive in terms of its scope. But I do think that, first of all, STEM has been changed to STEAM, so it's basically rarely called STEM anymore because they've added the arts. So it is now called STEAM. The other thing is that if you look at some of these infant toys and toddler toys, and you watch how children play with them, it's all about creativity, and it's all about problem solving, and it's all about open-ended thinking. What happens is once we get into formal education, we begin to narrow that down. So the idea today is to really be pushing now outward so that there is more creativity that includes project work, teamwork, instill the skills. But also, STEM is more than technology. I mean, some of the aspect of STEM has to do with scientific inquiry, mathematical thinking, and you don't get to those kinds of levels of conceptual thinking and creativity sometimes with the skills, but sometimes without them. And I think this talk is really enhancing what we're talking about. But I just want the conversation to be a little careful not to bottleneck STEM, which is now STEAM, into too tight of a non-thinking aspect of what we're talking about here.
Okay. Karen, thank you. First of all, thanks for the praise of the program. And I know all of our guests want to jump in now. Amanda, why don't you start? Go ahead.
Sure. So I really, really appreciate what that caller had to say. And it's interesting. I just last month had a conversation with a bunch of STEM majors at Geneseo, asking them their thoughts on the humanities and that sort of thing. And this interesting discussion kind of came out where some of what the caller was saying kind of came out in terms of the importance of not boxing STEM into, you know, just being about technology or just being about the sort of daily, you know, products that are created. So one person who was a scientific researcher who was there, you know, talked about unlocking the secrets of nature and the value of that. And there's a certain way, I think, in which STEM and humanities come together on that sort of point of, like, think about the sense of wonder that's there in terms of the value of learning about nature and knowledge for its own sake. So I think that should be part of our conversation, as the caller says, that, you know, we don't want to think STEM produces things and humanities just thinks about things. It's not just that.
Okay, Michael?
No, I totally agree. And, you know, one of the things that I've been trying to do in the almost 2 years that I've been at MCC as a dean is to encourage partnerships that cross disciplines so that students do have that experience. Again, I don't want my engineer or somebody, you know, who wants a really technical trade or occupation to not major in that technical you know, discipline. At the same time, there need to be opportunities where that problem solving is imbued into the curriculum. And whether that happens in contextualized courses or whether that happens through team teaching, which is when I was an undergraduate at the University of Buffalo, my most memorable educational experience was a team taught class in this particular respect. It doesn't matter to me. Those experiences need to be had, and they need to be had much more extensively.
All right, about a minute left, Eric Berridge. Some final thoughts from you on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate the caller's viewpoints there, and I think it's really important to acknowledge that this is a very complex topic, and it's really about having a dialogue in our society about how we want to prepare people for the future. And I think the key is just to have a fabric of individuals that breed diversity and encourage different types of thought, encourage different types of education. We need to be honest with each other. We need to have, we share some core values, and we need to take advantage of technology to make our lives better. That's the key here. It's not technology for technology's sake. We shouldn't be building bridges to nowhere. We should be building bridges to make community stronger. And I think that's really what this discussion needs to be about.
Yeah, Eric has often said diversity matters for all companies, and it matters in a lot of different ways, including diversity of thought, diversity of educational background. And that's what Blue Wolf has been doing. Eric, I really look forward to what you're going to bring to Rochester, and I'm grateful for the time you took for the program today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been really, really fun.
Eric Berridge, CEO of Blue Wolf. Michael Jacobs from the Humanities, the Institute for the Humanities at MCC. Michael, thank you. Amanda Roth from SUNY Geneseo, thank you to you as well. And one more time, next Wednesday night, 6 to 8:30, register where? What can people do?
Register at sites.monroecc.edu/humanities.
Piece of cake, sites.monroecc.edu/humanities. Let them know you're coming. It's free. 6 o'clock, Wednesday, May 1st, a week from tonight, why STEM needs the arts and humanities. Thanks to John Andrus, the engineer, Megan Mack is the producer, Don volunteering. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.